I'm Ben Weingarten.
I'm Emily Jashinsky.
I'm Josh Hammer.
And I'm Rachel Bovard.
And this is NatCon Squad, where common sense and common good meet. NatCon Squad is brought to you by the Edmund Burke Foundation, the home for national conservatism. Subscribe now on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. All right, well, let's jump right into today's episode. We've got four meaty subjects to get to. We'll be starting with Rachel, who will talk a little bit about Apple's collusion with communist China. Then we'll go to Josh to talk about the new Republican coalition. Emily will talk to us about the new segregation of public school playgrounds on the basis of quote unquote equity. And then I'll be talking a little bit about the latest shenanigans coming from the January 6th so-called select committee. With that, let's turn it over to Rachel.
So I'm going to talk about a topic I think we actually come back to a lot on this podcast, which is, you know, the rise of China and what it means for us, I think, geostrategically, but also economically. And over at Newsweek, Josh published a recent op-ed from Gordon Chang, which I thought was really illuminating to the latter point about how China is, you know, dominating us economically, often with the help and assistance of our own companies. And specifically, Gordon's talking about a secret agreement that was struck between Apple and China in 2016, which has now come to light, in which Apple agrees for the purpose of, you know, operating in the country and being able to move freely. They agree to a host of Chinese requirements that are everything you would really expect from, you know, a communist superpower. Everything from flat out, you know, agreeing to lie about geography, you know, on its apps, you know, creating islands off the coast of Japan that China thinks it owns, you know, bigger than they actually are. Apple's like, yeah, sure, we'll do that. To basically agreeing to help Chinese companies develop, quote, the most advanced manufacturing technologies, end quote. So, you know, this is really at this point, US companies not just, you know, doing business with a hostile state, but openly supporting and being a, you know, helpmate to a state that is hostile to the United States. And so, you know, this of course, I think the context of this is important too. And I think Gordon lays this out in a very damning way about how China has basically used our economy against us, right? It's not that they're simply letting these companies in out of goodwill, right? They expect things from them, not only, you know, the terms and agreements, you know, that they make them sign. This is in addition to the cybersecurity law that was passed in China that allows the Chinese government access to every part of, you know, data flow that operates within Chinese borders from any company, you know, originating anywhere in the world. But also China is rallying US companies to advocate for or against legislation here in the United States that the Chinese government supports or opposes. And that is just an active level of weaponization that I think, you know, we have not discussed here. And I think that's unfamiliar to a lot of people. So Tim Cook, the CEO of Apple, really does seem to think he's holding on to this blinkered, conceited belief that I think has been, you know, overturned at this point, that somehow doing business with China will liberalize it. Doing business with China, you know, will help China. And it's like, guys, you know, from Nixon going to China, from us giving them normal trade status to their ascension to the World Trade Organization, this has been proven false. They have used what we, I think, very innocently offered as a helping hand, although who knows if we do anything innocently. But, you know, I do think there was a lot of goodwill behind that. And they've used that power and our effort to liberalize them to outflank us economically and geostrategically. And so much of what we are now up against is because we have been complicit in this effort to somehow, you know, work with China, and our companies now actively assist them. So I think, you know, I come back to this theme I talk about a lot, but like, what is it that we do about it? Because Gordon, you know, takes the advice in the piece of the CEO of Palantir, which, you know, where he suggests, well, you know, companies that do business with China or are entangled with them should be forced to disclose this in ways they aren't now. And I think that would help. Sure, transparency is always good in this situation, but these companies have no shame. They are shameless about this. I mean, Apple repeatedly says it doesn't use Chinese slave labor when it does, and it is actively opposing legislation that would penalize companies that use Chinese slave labor. They have no shame. And so I guess the larger point and the question for the group is, what do we actually do about this? Because we are unable as a country to confront China on its most powerful terrain, which is economically, the most, because our, you know, our business elite are entangled with them. The most we can do is what the Biden government's like hand waving attempt, which is a diplomatic boycott of the Olympics. And I'm sorry, that's just, it's just pathetic. So I would throw it open to the group for your responses to that.
Ben, why don't you hop in first here? Because your recent piece for Newsweek also about Ray Dalio, you kind of actually get directly to what Rachel's asking at the very end, I think.
Yeah, I think the simple answer is, and I think, Rachel, you frame this very well in terms of the idea that it is America that has essentially served, or American enterprise that has served as the great accessory of the Chinese Communist Party. And I would argue, incidentally, that China's economic power is based more than anything on America's engagement with communist China. It's our capital markets, it's our operating companies, and then it's our unregistered foreign agents on behalf of communist China who do its bidding in effect in Washington and beyond as a consequence of these relations, who have empowered, created our greatest, most formidable adversary. So I agree with you. At the end of the day, corporations can't be named and shamed ultimately into breaking from communist China, with rare exceptions, I guess. And I give credit to the Women's Tennis Association, for example. I wish in myriad other organizations would follow their lead. I don't think that companies are going to act of their own volition here, even with the shifting out of supply chains to a degree during the Trump years, and even with Trump himself advocating that U.S. businesses should get out of China almost verbatim. At one point during his presidency, ultimately, there needs to be law explicitly aimed at breaking all American financing of operations on behalf of or in conjunction with, and then serving as unregistered foreign agents for communist China, period, full stop. And it may not be that you need ultimately a ban altogether on any operations within China, or a complete delisting by decree of every single CCP-linked entity, period, full stop, from U.S. exchanges. It may be that a few massive changes, whether it's saying that a company violates sanctions, say a major bank is violating sanctions by, in effect, underwriting, advising, serving as an accomplice of the Chinese Communist Party in its most malign efforts. It may be that one or two outsized moves might cause ripple effects that could cause us to not have to use, allow us to do a more scalpel-based sort of attack rather than taking a chainsaw to it. But that said, I think the threat of the chainsaw has to be there, because it's the only way to get us out of this poisonous panda hug that we've been ensnared in for all too long. We have to get ourselves out of this inextricably intertwined relationship, or it will kill us ultimately.
Right. So I guess I have two points to add here. First of all, on a kind of a shameless plug note, I'm very fortunate, very blessed to have such a great staple of anti-Chinese Communist Party writers writing for me at Newsweek. So thanks to Rachel for flagging Gordon's column. Ben, of course, writes prolifically on this issue for me at Newsweek, or us at Newsweek, I should say, as well. So just two quick points that I kind of only want to add here. The first point, this is something that we've kind of said over and over again, this podcast. Whose side at the end of the day are these individuals on? Like Tim Cook, if you were to ask him, okay, are you an American? Do you support America? Will you say the Pledge of Allegiance? He would say yes. But the conduct that Gordon wrote about and that Rachel has talked about here, I don't think it's exaggeration to say that it is borderline treasonous. There is no way of looking at what companies like Apple and what Tim Cook have done, and then concluding that he solely and exclusively has the allegiance and the best interests of the American Republic and the American way of life in mind. So at the end of the day, like, whose countries are they on? And that I get is obviously to what is the proper remedy here. And I think, as Ben says, like, the remedy has to be state action, okay? Like, there is no way that the incentives are going to be aligned in any other way to kind of rein in kind of woke capital, Fortune 500, Silicon Valley, Wall Street, really kind of obviously kind of higher education too, through the Confucius Institutes and all the various methods of infiltration that the CCP has on the university campus. Something has to happen as a matter of kind of political action. The question then is, what form of action does that take? So I was in DC this past week, and I got brunch last weekend with a very smart conservative couple friend of mine. I won't say their names here. But we were kind of debating this. The problem, I guess, with the legislative approach, and we saw this when Rachel was talking about, is that the CCP has so many useful idiot toadies in the kind of the Bismarckian sausage-making process to kind of gum up the works and muddle any kind of legislation. This is kind of the pushback that my friend at this brunch that I was at was kind of giving me here. So it's tough to be optimistic that any kind of clean, disentangled, divest from China bill could emerge. which incidentally, I guess kind of augurs or militates, I should say, in favor of some sort of kind of executive action, probably using some sort of authority that Congress has previously delegated to the executive branch over the course of the past 80, 90 years here. And that kind of gets us into kind of some thorny debates about kind of using flawed constitutional law precedent to pursue our agenda. But I guess at the end of the day, that's probably our most straightforward path possible. It's just very difficult to see how even an issue of this importance, how Congress could unite on it in a way that evades Chinese special interests.
This is an outrageous story, as everybody has already underscored. It is stunning. It is stunning. It's more stunning than Nike calling themselves a Chinese company. And I think to Josh's example of would Tim Cook, who was my commencement speaker, by the way, put his hand over his heart and say he's an American and recite the national anthem, he would. And then he would, though, prioritize himself more as a citizen of the world. This is the elite sort of mindset that we are a global citizenry before we are an American citizenry, which is an outrageous way to look at it. You should lose any tax benefits that you get in the United States of America if you are participating in the Chinese economy in this way. It may not fit the legal constitutional definition of treason. It fits my definition, my informal definition of treason. It's aiding and abetting a country that is aligned against our interests and against our people's interests. And you can define treason narrowly and still have this fit, that not necessarily legal or constitutional one, but this is, I think you should lose any benefit. If you are a company engaged in anything like this, you should lose every single tax benefit that you get. We need to disincentivize this kind of conduct culturally. This should be a huge stain on the public relations reputation of Apple. And it should, but of course the corporate media hasn't covered it because they're all complicit in similar ways. And on top of it, this should be legally punished. So culturally stigmatized, legally stigmatized, and that's the next step forward.
Go ahead, Josh. I was just going to say, just to invoke executive privilege to conclude, if there's one thing I'm confident in, it's that Hunter Biden's father will not be the one imposing such a policy.
Well, that's certainly true, I think, needless to say here. But this is actually a perfectly fine segment to what I want to talk about here. So we're talking the previous segment about kind of the imperative to crack down on woke capital, on Fortune 500, on conglomerate America, big tech, all these kind of nefarious woke actors that we talk about in this podcast every week. And, you know, I want to talk about kind of the emergence of what the new Republican coalition looks like here, because there's been some very interesting kind of recent polls, some recent data points on this. And none of this is going to be particularly new news for the listeners and the viewers of this podcast, because these are kind of the leitmotifs and the recurrent themes that we talk about all the time here. But I guess from my perspective, look, if you kind of go back, you know, as far back, let's start very briefly in like the 1960s, around the time of kind of like Nelson Rockefeller and the Rockefeller Republicans. You know, the Republican Party was kind of like the WASPy country club party, obviously, right? And like back then, at least the left purported to, and many times, at least more often than today, actually kind of did stand with kind of the working man. There was kind of a strong stand actually of kind of like labor protectionism at that time and kind of the union dominated Democratic Party and whatnot. And that kind of very roughly was the coalition, at least until kind of the 1980s, when kind of, you know, Reagan Bush and Reagan in particular made strong inroads and kind of those Reagan Democrats, if you will, those kind of predominantly Catholic voters in the Rust Belt who belonged to a union but were kind of culturally commonsensical. And those trend lines basically continued. And I guess as recently as kind of the 2012 Romney-Ryan ticket, the Republicans started to shed some voters in the suburbs. The shedding wasn't too extreme in 2012, in part because that ticket stood for nothing if not fiscal austerity, which is, I guess, kind of a traditional kind of middle to upper class suburban issue, if there were ever one. But by the time that Trump kind of, you know, stole the 2016 Republican presidential nomination in a landslide, and certainly by the time that he prevailed in that shocking general election, you know, the Republican coalition really had started to shift, right, from kind of that old school kind of WASPy country club to kind of a truly kind of blue collar and predominantly largely white working class coalition. I mean, and I think any kind of sober assessment of the data in 2016 does show that it was white working class voters in particular that certainly carried Trump Pence over Clinton Kaine. I had to think for a second who really Clinton's running mate was. I literally almost forgot. But you know, a lot of times over, like oftentimes over the 4 years of the Trump presidency, people on the right talked about the emergence of this kind of multi-ethnic working class coalition. And it was kind of almost like a will to power kind of thing. A lot of people kind of talked about it, and they really just like really wanted it to be to appear, to kind of take away from kind of the perceived stigma of a predominantly white coalition. And I guess the data is now starting to trickle in such a way that kind of shows that that really actually is starting to transpire here. I mean, we kind of saw anecdotes of it in the 2020 election itself, of course. I mean, I'm recording this from Miami, Florida. I live in Miami. In Miami-Dade County, which is a massively Hispanic county, not just the Cuban population, but Venezuelan, Colombian, there's all sorts of Latinos here. And by the way, they prefer to be called Latinos, not Latinx or Latinx or whatever the hell the progressives are trying to call them. You know, this county swung from a massive Clinton margin 2016 to a single digit 7 to 9 point margin of victory in 2016 here. And then, of course, back in Texas, where I used to live, if you go back in the down in the Rio Grande Valley, some of these counties, Starr County, Texas, Zapata County, Texas, 90 to 95% Hispanic counties overrun by illegal immigration, destroyed by the cartels, heavily Mexican, were giving Trump outright victories here in those counties. So the couple of recent polls that I kind of want to just flag, and then I'm happy to kind of just basically just kick it off on that note. So there was a Quinnipiac University poll recently in Texas, the aforementioned state of Texas, where Greg Abbott is running for re-election next fall, assuming that he can get by his primary challengers. So Abbott right now is up by 15 points on Robert Francis, aka Beto O'Rourke. But most interestingly, Abbott actually outright leads Beto among Texas Hispanic voters by 3 points, 44 to 41. And Texas Hispanic voters apparently disapprove of Joe Biden's job performance by a 27-point margin. Now, lest you think that that is solely limited to Texas, where the Hispanic population has traditionally leaned a little more conservative than otherwhere, not necessarily the case. So apparently on the generic Republican versus Democrat ballot for next fall, a Wall Street Journal poll shows that Hispanics nationally are evenly split 37-37. National Hispanics disapprove of Biden's job performance by 12 points. And they support Biden over Trump in a 2024 hypothetical matchup, but by literally 1 point, 44-43. So it seems like the Hispanic vote is completely up in the air right now. We saw the Trump ticket last fall make some marginal, smaller, obviously, but some smaller inroads in some segments of the Black community as well here. So I guess it's kind of kick it up into you guys. I mean, like, do you share these the optimism that I think kind of emanates from these polls about kind of the GOP's inroads and the Hispanic community, perhaps in particular?
I have never seen a party take for granted their support among a racial category so dramatically. Maybe the African-American community rivals like how Democrats view Hispanics. But I saw some polling not that long ago, which was basically showing the, you know, among Hispanics, among Latinos, just really strong levels of support for border security, right? And all of the things that Trump cracked down on, which Republicans will talk about from time to time, but it was actually really shocking to me to see it in a poll. And I just think Democrats for so long have just taken for granted their support from this group of people that they've stopped working for it. They've done incredibly stupid things like invent the term Latinx, which Politico had a hilarious article about a week or two ago, referencing a statistic that said like 40% of Hispanics are actually offended by the term and would like not vote for people who use it. Like talk about something backfiring so spectacularly. Like I actually like laughed out loud reading the article. So, you know, this just goes to like basic electoral strategy for any party. You cannot take for granted support from anyone. You have to work for these votes. And I think more than that, it's, you know, especially this happens on the left, I think more so, but I always see the temptation on the right to break people down into racial categories and to speak to them as though they are nothing more than that racial category and that everything that matters to them is through that lens. And it just is not true, you know, at all. And we see this repeatedly, but no political party seems to learn this lesson.
I don't know how durable it is, but I've seen increasing signs, and this is among them, that Democrats overreached. They're sort of drunk on their own power and authority in 2020 has actually branded them in ways that may have consequences, concrete consequences, not just consequences because Van Jones criticizes them on CNN every once in a while, but like real electoral consequences, cultural consequences. I think they didn't really understand how taking the ball and running with it in all of these different ways, making Ibram X. Kendi a best-selling author and adopting his ideas into your platform and your policies, I don't think they realized that while they were out there scoring, racking up virtue signal points, how bad that was ultimately going to turn out to be. They're reckoning with it right now to an extent. So I don't know how durable it is. I know, you know, establishment Democrats here nationally, they are culturally really radical and far to the left, but they also are way more concerned about power than ideology in the same way as the establishment right is. So we'll see if they're able to meaningfully reckon with this, or if they have created the monster that destroys them. And that's, I think, the balance here is if when they realize increasingly that this is turning off voters in categories that have often voted in big margins for Democrats, if they realize that, can they even stop it? Will that even matter? I don't know. I don't have a good answer. Like I said, I don't know how durable this will be, but the signs are shockingly good.
So I'd say there are a couple forces at work here. And let me just preface by saying never underestimate the Republicans' ability to screw up a layup that has been presented to them by the disaster that is leftism being imposed across the country. It's clear based upon polling, and this even, I might even predate Trump, which shows that among minority groups, including Black Americans, rank and file voters are far less woke and radical than the elite leftists who predominate in the cultural sphere and then who have also dominated in the ideological sphere, because the Democrat Party now is a radically progressive party. It's more the party of the squad than James Clyburn, for example. At the same time, the Trump agenda, of course, itself broke the mold and had a more populist bent, both rhetorically and in terms of policy as well. And I think those two trends, the radical wokeism of the left, which is out of touch with its, you know, the minorities who vote majority Democrat, plus those Trump policies led to shifts that have seemingly continued. And I think they've continued in large part because everything that progressivism touches collapses. If you look, bread and butter policies, are your children going to have a better education? Are you going to have a decent job? Are you going to be able to afford basic necessities? Is there a chance for you to pursue your dreams in this country? Can you actually walk to the street corner without fear of getting shot? In how many different urban areas are these questions now all up for grabs? I mean, the disasters of progressivism are clear. And consequently, there's a huge opportunity for Republicans on these very bread and butter issues to put forth a compelling argument and a compelling vision and to make these trends durable and robust and continue to proceed in the direction they are proceeding. But it requires treating people as people, not as groups, to that point. I hate the idea that we break down the electorate into these racial categories when each person is an individual with their own agency. And while we may look at these immutable characteristics and say, well, typically this person's going to vote this way, that's certainly not the way that voters should be spoken to. And that's certainly not the way the policies should be thought of. It should be about creating the best flourishing life for every individual in the country. And if Republicans put forth a message like that with policies behind it, they can win ever increasing shares of voters that have so disdained and ignored and dismissed the Republican Party for decades.
Yeah, so I'll probably come back to this in closing thoughts, but just a very quickly typo on this and then kick it over to Emily here. Look, again, like where I'm sitting here in Miami, like a hub for Latin American immigration, the people that are coming here from Colombia, Venezuela, all these failed narco states, these cartel overrun, homicide, murder states, they're coming here because they believe in America. They don't want to come here and then be told by Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez that we are an irredeemably systemically racist nation. They don't want to hear that. That's not why they came here. It's basically that simple, honestly. But on that note, Emily, what's going on the playgrounds?
It's a perfect segue. I mean, it's just a completely perfect segue. I'm going to read this headline from the Federalist. Denver Elementary School plans racially segregated playground night in the name of equity. And the reason I wanted to talk about this story is because the image, which was first tweeted out by Chris Rufo, is stark. He tweeted out a picture of one of the signs outside the elementary school, Centennial Elementary in Denver. This is a public school. And on that sign, it says, Families of Color Playground Night, Wednesday, December 8th at 4:10 p.m. Now, according to the staff, that was organized by the school's, quote, dean of culture. They originally canceled it during COVID because of COVID, and now it's back. But looking at a sign in 2021 that says Families of Color Playground Night is one of the most disgusting experiences I think anybody could have in their community. It is neo-segregation, and it may be in the name of a positive, what they believe to be a positive ambition. But in practice, what critical race theory that has trickled into younger and younger ages, trickled into the curriculum of people that are of younger and younger ages, the effect of that is neo-segregation. That is the consequence of it. And this sign puts it so starkly. This is an elementary school, a public elementary school that is advertising. It's not ashamed of it. It's advertising a segregated playground event. It's segregation. And I remember this bubbling up on college campuses over the last 10 years. I think it was like CSULA was one of the first schools to have a dorm that was only for students of color. And we saw that more and more. And it looked really gross, but people dismissed it. They said this was college campuses. This is being overhyped by the right, et cetera, et cetera. But here it is. And it's the product of a very incoherent ideology that now governs our institutions, even our elementary schools, because they have deans of culture. It's what happens when you inflate the bureaucracy at these institutions. You have deans of culture that organize segregated events. And so I think this is actually a really good extension of the discussion we just had, because it's a reminder that these policies are they're reprehensible. They aren't merely sort of politically damaging. And I think that's very true as well, but their logical conclusions are rewinding the clock that people have fought and died and bled and sweated to change in this country. I mean, so many people have put their lives on the line, lost their lives to create an equal society, not an equitable society. And that's what this is. This is equity. This is saying we need to give you a segregated playground night in order to, you know, lift you to the same place that white students are on. So let me open this up to the group and talk about what you guys think the sort of national implications of something like this are. What does this tell us about the country right now?
I mean, I'm happy to hop in first, I guess. I mean, look, it's just a terrible data point, obviously. I mean, it's kind of an anecdotal kind of lens through which to view kind of all the current maladies afflicting America. I mean, look, I mean, what happened to E Pluribus Unum? I mean, for God's sake, like what happened to one out of many? What happened to kind of the idea of America as kind of a melting pot of cultures? I mean, you know, I'm 32 years old and I feel like I grew up in like a different era. I mean, you know, I went to public school K through 12 my entire life. I mean, I feel like when I was growing up, to kind of paraphrase my good friend David Azarad, I was kind of inculcated with the belief that Martin Luther King was the closest thing that America had to like a patron saint. And I don't say that necessarily kind of in a pejorative fashion, because Martin Luther King was a heroic figure in so many ways here. But, you know, Martin Luther King, I mean, the entire notion of judging someone not based on the content of their or the color of their skin, but on the content of the character, I mean, that's totally anathema now, right? I mean, like Ibram X. Kendi stands for the precise opposite proposition of that when he so famously or infamously, as the case may be, says that the way to remedy past discrimination is by current and future discrimination. It's literally the antithesis of the MLK synthesis. So, I mean, I just feel like I grew up in like a different America, and it's just data points like this, you know, it's just so saddening, right? I mean, like this is how countries unravel, right? I mean, you know, when our friends like Dave Riebel and Jesse Kelly start talking about national divorce, this is kind of like, you know, the black pill of all black pills. That's not personally my stance, to clarify, but like when our friends start talking about that, it's data points like this that come to mind here. It's just very difficult to see sometimes how we can kind of come back to an E Pluribus Unum framework and mindset when stuff like this is happening, obviously. But in any event, that's, you know, that's the work of the four of us and this podcast and our friends. We're trying, obviously, to forestall that black pill.
I think you did grow up. We all grew up in a different world though, Josh. And, you know, we don't use a lot of personal anecdotes on this podcast, but I'm going to use a personal anecdote and just talk about my father-in-law. So my husband is black and his father grew up here in DC, in segregated DC, you know, marched in the civil rights movement, was jailed after the 1968 riots, has an amazing, incredible story about how this country has changed. And the son he raised, and he talks about this still, he raised him so that he could fit in anywhere. I mean, that was the philosophy that my husband was raised with, is that, yes, you're a Black man in America, but you are no different. And that is the legacy of the civil rights movement. And when you talk to the people who marched and were, you know, a part of that movement, they are confused by this moment. And I think, you know, they feel betrayed, I think, a little bit, or confused, right? Because, you know, they're being literally, what they were trying to fight for is being turned back on them. And obviously, that's just my personal anecdote. It doesn't speak for everybody in the Black community, though I suspect it, you know, does resonate with certain generations. But Josh, I don't think you're wrong to say that we did grow up in a different world. And this is why I reject the notions from the left that things like critical race theory are just grievance politics and they're just being blown out of proportion, because this is a deadly and insidious in mentality that this country went through, you know, throes and thrashes to get rid of. And so to allow it to creep back in under the guise of equity, I just think does irreparable harm to this country.
Yeah, equity destroys equality in this country. It undermines our most essential values and principles. I think the fact that we see this now at elementary school is actually makes total logical sense, given that we've seen, for example, that for years now, there have been segregated graduation ceremonies at some of the most elite universities in the country. Different ethnic groups have their own graduations. Obviously, there's separate housing by group, et cetera, et cetera. It is the complete opposite of the melting pot. And really, it's rooted at its core, even though there's this pseudo intellectual veneer to it, it's really a divide and conquer and accumulate power scheme at the end of the day. That's what all of identity politics is. It is about picking out these characteristics, dividing people on the basis of those characteristics rather than on their merits, what they bring to the table, their substance. And then using that to polarize people and accrue power as a consequence of it. I think what's particularly devastating here, though, is we're talking about, you know, lower education. Higher education, even if all of us probably have our misgivings about 18 to 21 year olds and how ready they are to deal with the indoctrination they're going to face in schools, especially with the suspended adolescence that, you know, the modern generation, including probably all of us to some extent, all operated in. The fact that this happens in lower education is even more devastating, because obviously kids are even more impressionable at that age. And I think this points to the broader strategy of the left, which is an assault on faith and the values and principles that make us virtuous human beings, and the country to be free relies upon a virtuous people, the attack on the family structure broadly, and then of course the attack on the schools down to the lowest level of the schools. If you are able to hijack all of those institutions or undermine them, ultimately you win the ideas and then you win the politics, and that's the entire strategy. And this is just one of the myriad pernicious seeds, the poisonous fruit of that strategy. So I think it should underscore, first of all, how far behind we are, and second of all, how pervasive this all of society indoctrination effort is.
Yeah. And before we transition, all I'll just say is, you know, a lot of people would argue this is an outlier. And I think it is an outlier in the sense that it's so stark. But I actually think this mentality is very, very widespread. And we have to be careful not to underestimate how deeply ingrained it is in a generation of young people, people who grew up in a different America and were conditioned to see the world with this framework. And that could be a really scary thing to shape our politics in the next couple of decades.
Right. So with that, speaking of our disastrous politics, there have been a number of recent revelations in the January 6th Select Committee, which continues right on into likely the midterm elections. And it's worth noting before jumping into some of these revelations that there were plenty of other investigations that Congress was undertaking separate and apart from this Select Committee. The Select Committee is obviously one-sided and partisan. It is purely, essentially, the most ardent haters of anything resembling a national conservatism agenda. It's a show trial. It's not actually aimed at any of the points that it claims to be aimed at in terms of getting to the bottom of what happened on January 6th. It uses the notion of seeking to understand the causes of what transpired for the insurrection, which the DOJ has not called an insurrection or sedition in any of the cases, leveled against the defendants in the cases, et cetera, et cetera. So all I'm saying is, before we jump into this, we have to understand that the left is not operating in good faith here in any sense, obviously, while we try to grapple with what the committee is doing on the merits. All that said, a few recent revelations. First of all, Liz Cheney, it appears, leaked communications that Mark Meadows had, which actually ended up being a self-own because they were exculpatory about the role of the president's closest staffers and what was being communicated and what was known about what was to transpire at the Capitol at January 6th, beginning while the president was still speaking at a separate rally from what transpired there. Then we found out, all credit to the Federalists here, that Adam Schiff, it appears, was Freudian slip there, was doctoring some text messages that were released and leaked out by the committee as well, made to show communications that were purportedly between Meadows and Jim Jordan, and it appears they were not. And the committee was caught by the Federalist on this, and it appears has admitted now that they were in fact doctoring some of the leaked messages, a further self-owned to some extent from the committee. And then of course we have Mark Meadows being held in criminal contempt, just another Trump world figure being held in contempt. And he incidentally was, of course, cooperating with the committee and providing all manner of documents, including these personal text messages, but raised the issue of executive privilege, which still needs to be fully litigated. And the committee held him in criminal contempt. Stepping back from these particulars with the committee, I think every single action that we see shows that this isn't just about engaging in a political person, trying to make the political case that the legal prosecution can't make, but in reality, it is a raw spectacle of the abuse of power against one's political opponents using communications collected by network companies, going down to people's emails and text messages dating back weeks and weeks, if not months and months, and covering dozens of people and numerous organizations as well, all of which is about using the absolute awesome powers that Congress has in tow with the national security state to threaten, chill, and break anyone who dares dissent from their agenda. Now, of course, this is framed as President Donald Trump incited a domestic terror attack, the likes of which we haven't seen since Pearl Harbor, on the country. Now, the facts obviously do not comport with that narrative. But I think at this point, the left isn't even trying to make that case through this committee. What they're really trying to do is break the opposition. Of course, there are obviously implications for 2024, trying to hang this around the neck of potentially a President Trump running again, and anyone else who would dare challenge what the Select Committee itself is up to. It strikes me that it doesn't really pass muster that there's a political purpose necessarily in terms of, like, this is something that people are going to run on going into the midterms. Maybe it's something the left can fundraise off of. But I do think one thing that the Select Committee stands as is a clear, brazen act, which shows that the more brazen the left acts, the weaker they think Republicans are. And so that leads me to kind of what I wanted to get to in this discussion, which is, what would change the calculus on the left so that they could never engage in an operation like this again? And what would be the proper remedy to ensure that the left does pay a substantial price for engaging in the kind of chicanery that they're engaging in here? And with that, I turn it over to sort of the practical and the strategic aspect of what's the right way to respond to this?
Well, I will say a group of conservatives, myself among them, just put out a joint letter calling on Kevin McCarthy to strip Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger of their status within the Republican conference because of how complicit they have been in the abject political persecution, in my mind, you know, of people, not just sort of the Mark Meadows of the world, but also the private citizens who have done nothing wrong and are just being dragged through the mud, legally harassed. Some of them will be bankrupt at the end of this process to no end. But to your larger point, I do think that the rest of the country just does not care. But I do think, you know, I think, you know, there are people on Twitter that care. And a lot of times Democrats seem to make their political strategy around Twitter. But I do think that there is a larger purpose here, because I'm sure some of them know they're bleeding here, but they are trying to bloody Trump. And they are, you know, ahead of 2024, and they are trying to make anyone who ever supported him or who will support him think twice about casting a vote in this democracy, because it now comes with strings, now comes with penalties. And that is a very, very dangerous thing for them to be doing, in my mind. Trump or no Trump.
So I guess the problem with January 6th in particular is, I think a lot of people have cognitive dissonance, right? A lot of people have a hard time kind of separating what actually happened on January 6th from the January 6th Select Committee, the political prisoners really who have been taken to solitary confinement for 22 to 24 hours a day, as people like Julie Kelly, Marina Medvin, who's a lawyer for a lot of these folks, as folks like that have kind of unveiled. But I think for a lot of people, they think back to those images from January 6th, obviously. And look, to be clear, there are a lot of people on the left, obviously, who say it was the worst day in American history. It was worse than 9/11. It was worse than Fort Sumter. It was worse than the British burning of the U.S. Capitol in the War of 1812. I mean, obviously, we all know that that is complete outrageous nonsense here. But January 6th, obviously, was not a particularly great day. I mean, to put it mildly, I mean, it was not a good thing for the Republic. I think we've all been on record as saying that over and over again. The people who physically kind of violate, I mean, these images are searing. So I guess the point that I'm making here is I think a lot of people, they have a hard time kind of being sympathetic to the extremely reasonable, sober, judicious, and ultimately correct points that folks like Julie Kelly and Ben have repeatedly made on the January 6th witch hunt, because they have, as the left is wont to do in the kind of classic Rahm Emanuel, never let a good crisis go to waste fashion, have obviously turned it into a witch hunt. But because of kind of like the lasting power of those visceral images that we all remember from our TV sets now almost a year ago, that's hard to believe. I think the median American has a hard time being sympathetic to what the message that we're trying to get out there on this. So I don't know, honestly, given kind of like the cultural currents and the fact that the media just is over and over again obsessed with kind of replaying the images of January 6th itself, I don't necessarily know that I have a compelling argument for how to do exactly what you and I think rightfully want us to do, Ben. But I mean, certainly Rachel's suggestion is a good start. I mean, you know, we're recording this on Wednesday. I mean, Tucker Carlson led off a show last night with a wonderful kind of 10 to 15 minute diatribe against Liz Cheney. I mean, certainly more of that would be a very good idea as a kind of a bare minimum, right?
Yeah, and I was going to talk actually about part of Tucker's monologue in which he showed how absurd the narrative from the corporate media has been. And listen, when I'm working from home, I keep MSNBC on all day. I keep it on mute. And when I look up at the screen, it seems like 60% of the time I'm looking at January 6th. It's unbelievable. And it's been that way for the past year. It doesn't just come in spurts. It is consistently this obsession with January 6th in a way that reminds me of the obsession they particularly in CNN had with the Russia hoax. It was every little new detail was an excuse to blow this into the news cycle in a substantive way, latching on to absolutely everything. And what Tucker hit on was the disconnect, the false reality that they have been presenting to the American public for a year, which is the text messages from Laura Ingraham and Sean Hannity and Donald Trump Jr. were like, this is horrible. This is terrible. And if you rewind the tapes, that's what they were all saying publicly that day. And it's this incredible trap. I agree with Josh. I'm not sure what the political implications of this are. I think average Americans don't want to touch this. It's like, this is wrong. This is the excesses of a lot of problems with Donald Trump. It resulted in something tragic and terrible, but this is a trap. I mean, Republicans were trapped here because it doesn't matter how they reacted. It literally didn't matter that everybody condemned it and had very thoughtful in some cases, beautiful statements on how wrong it was. It didn't matter because they have control of the media. They have control of the public's window into everything. And so they can get up there and spin it and say, look, Laura Ingraham is different in public than she is in private. And it's just not true. They can say that. It doesn't matter what's actually on tape. None of it matters. And so Republicans just have this impossible task ahead of them on every issue beyond just January 6th. But January 6th is probably the best example of it. It doesn't matter how responsibly anybody acted on that day, because when you control the media and you control the political establishment, you can get Nicole Wallace, you can get Don Lemon to just absolutely blow this up as a stain for the Republican Party. And then the real problem is we can never deal with it because Republicans have to spend their time debunking false narratives instead of reckoning with any of the flaws that led to it. And that's the saddest thing, is that if the left actually cared, they would stop with the BS, because the BS is what prevents the country from actually reckoning with the very real problems that I think existed with Donald Trump in this case and with other things. So it's a great example of how the media distorts our ability to deal with real problems.
I think on that note, and I'll take us right into final thoughts, but let me first say, I don't know who Don Lemon is. I know who Don Lemon is. So Lemon, I just want to clarify that.
It's pronounced sorbet.
But I do think it speaks to this broader like funhouse mirror thing that we're living in, where it's like, we need to be having the rational conversations that you just mentioned, Emily, but we are so incapable because everything from COVID to, you know, election interference to January 6th, you question the narrative at all, right? Then you are a complete and total conspiracy theorist. You are shut down from social media. There are actual punitive consequences to like your job, you know, if you are lumped in with these people. And that is, you know, just not the way a sane society deals with things. Like the best way to deal with a conspiracy theory, this is a basic knowledge for people, is to investigate it, right? Like there is always fraud in elections. This is just how elections work, but it's a matter of, was it enough, right? To tilt the balance. Why can't we just have a conversation about that? You know, why can't we have a conversation about, you know, the fact that the pandemic that started 2 years ago, the science has overwhelmingly shifted now that we know what the disease is, how it acts, we have treatments. Why are we still living like this? Why are we going to shut down the entire country again for winter because of the Omicron variant, which is more contagious, but far less severe? We're just living in this like upside down world where we can't even communicate. And I think there are many, many causes of this. You know, social media is one of them. I think just our partisan politics is another, you know, and just the country as cable news obviously doesn't contribute anything good to it either. But I mean, I hate ending on the black pill, but we need to pull ourselves back from this brink, because we have to be able, to be able to do anything at all, we have to be able to discuss things rationally, like the intelligent human beings we are, and we are just incapable right now.
So I'll do my final thought kind of going back to what I talked about, which is kind of the new Republican coalition here. So I want to just emphasize a little bit what Ben said in his response to that segment, which is totally correct, of course, which is it would be a massive and monumental mistake for the Republican Party to go down the one-way ratchet, irksome, horrible rabbit hole that is identity politics, obviously, and trying to kind of throw it. I mean, on the contrary, obviously, you know, in direct defiance to the infamous 2012 RNC autopsy, obviously, which kind of said, like, be nice on immigration, you know, maybe support some like amnesty. You know, on the contrary, Hispanic voters by and large want border security, because in places like Starr County and Zapata County, Texas, that are 95% Hispanic, those are the counties that are getting overrun and destroyed by open borders, by the cartels, and all the various kind of terrible antecedents of those terrible policies there. But the slightly related point that I want to make there is that at the same time, it is very important for the Republican Party to not take for granted the white working class voters, who are still and will be for the foreseeable future the bread and butter of the Republican coalition there. And, you know, that has to play out in terms of kind of concrete policies there. I mean, obviously, you know, kind of like Joe Sixpack, right, in middle America, doesn't want to be told that his children are going to be are grown up like from the womb, from the moment of conception, that they are in kind of Calvinist predetermination fashion are ipso facto racist. That is terrible. Okay. And like it is the Republican Party's kind of unique prerogative to fight back against that evil narrative there. And not just in kind of the cultural kind of like racial civilizational issues too, but also in kind of on some bread and butter economic matters there, pushing back against kind of the excesses of neoliberal orthodoxy, job outsourcing, kind of free trade absolutism, like entanglement with China. All of that has to play out in a way that kind of directly empowers the working class in particular. But specifically, I think it would be a massive mistake. On the one hand, I mean, look, two things can be true at once, okay? Republicans cannot take this kind of working class Hispanic population inroads for granted. They should not and they must not. But at the same time, they cannot kind of solely and exclusively focus on nurturing that to the exclusion, to the exclusivity of the white working class that is and will remain for the foreseeable future, its electoral backbone as well.
Okay, so I'll jump in really briefly and say somewhat related to all that we've discussed in this episode. Recently, there have been a couple cases at the Supreme Court that have been dismissed where those individuals and organizations have called for injunctive relief around these state mandates, particularly in Maine and New York, for healthcare workers to get vaccinated. And the states have not granted carve-outs for and respected the religious exemptions sought by those who do have a faith-based justification, even though you shouldn't need one, in my opinion, for refusing these mandates. And I think what it shows at the Supreme Court, and this extends through all of our institutions, is that scientism and wokeism, and we saw the wokeism part, of course, during the summer riots of 2020, scientism and wokeism have now been elevated above religion, above conscience, above the First Amendment protected rights of Americans, all throughout our system, up to and including the highest court in the land. Now, I think this should give everyone pause who assumes that it's going to be a layup when it comes to challenging the OSHA mandate around companies of 100 or more people, vaccine mandates. I think this should call into question maybe how confident we are that the so-called 6-3 conservative court is going to stand up and do anything there. And I also think this has implications for potentially the Dobbs decision as well. So besides the fact that we should look very skeptically at what we're going to get out of the Supreme Court, it underscores the fact that there is no institution in government that cares about protecting and preserving our natural rights. At the end of the day, ultimately, this comes down to us. It's we the people. Our representatives do not really represent the 50% of the country that relatively has its head on straight. The Supreme Court is not going to stand there and defend our rights at the highest court in the land. At the end of the day, it all comes down to us and who we elect as our representatives. And this only underscores the need for mass primarying of Republicans and taking out of Democrats alike over the next 2 to 4 years at a time of existential threat domestically and externally as well.
Yeah, I think we've just drifted so far away, and thinking about the elementary schools, it's a good just illustration. We've drifted so far away from the peak American ideal, which certainly still had work to be done and always would, because humans are flawed and fallen and cannot create a government or a corporate sector that isn't also flawed and fallen. But it's very sad how we've drifted so far from that peak of the American ideal that I think we had experienced. And again, that's not to say that there wasn't work to be done, but on the sort of broad contours of these questions, they really had, and we had the legal framework to treat everybody equally, and that's actually under threat now. It's just hard to think about how quickly the country has changed from being on the right trajectory to being deeply on the wrong trajectory, having taken somewhat of a U-turn, actually a complete U-turn, driving back in the opposite direction. We had so much good, and I think we shouldn't underestimate the extent to which technology, which is making a lot of people very rich and is very much benefiting our enemy and the Chinese Communist Party, has divided us, has set our culture back. And that's something we need to start thinking very seriously about. So that's my final thought.
Well, on that sunny note, on behalf of Josh, Emily, and Rachel, I'm Ben Weingarten, and we'll see you at the next NatCon Squad.